Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now open session pursuant to adjournment.
Want to be seated, please?
The first case on our calendar is 98-1333, State of Ohio versus Rayshon Johnson. Mr. Higley.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. The ambition to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal. Several important issues are raised in this case. Unusual issues are the contact between the trial judge and the jurors during the guilt phase of the proceedings. This is a defendant watched after the court one day from his cell in the Justice Center. He saw one of his jurors leave the courthouse, go down to the sidewalk, and the vehicle pulled up. And after waiting a while, she got in the vehicle. It went. He wrote his lawyer's note. Next morning, say he thought it was a court personnel, I believe, was the language he used to note it and brought to the attention of the trial court before the trial recommenced on that next morning. And the trial court immediately said, well, she missed her bus. So I gave her a ride to the parking lot. And if you read the transcript, that portion of which is appended to the brief, you can see that I think the shock in the prosecutor's remark, you were the one?
How did that come to be? How was that discussed? Did the court come in the next day and say, gentlemen, I have something to tell you about what happened, and I think you ought to know about it?
No. In the record, the first thing, at least it's in the transcript, the defense counsel mentions a letter. And I think there was some discussion earlier that the letter was presented to the judge, because I believe the defense counsel indicated, I think, Your Honor, that you have an explanation or something to say. So I think at the point when the record starts, at least the defense was aware that it was the judge.
Well, did the defense bring it to the attention of the court, or did the court bring it to the attention of the parties?
The defense brought it to the attention of the court. The defendant gave a letter to his lawyers. His lawyers then explored the matter, because I believe the letter indicated that it didn't say the judge.
Is it your position that that creates a presumption of prejudice? If you say that it creates a presumption of prejudice, is it a rebuttable presumption?
I think it is.
Was it not properly rebutted both by the juror and the judge? Why not? They both said they didn't talk about the case.
They said they didn't talk about the case, and the Remmer decision from the Supreme Court does have the qualifier about the matter pending. Boston versus Connor decision. This court just says any contact. But
well, if you say any contact, then that would appear that it's an irrebuttable presumption. The mere fact the judge had contact with the juror would then be presumed prejudicial.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean that it was not rebuttable. I didn't read Bostic as at least making any big deal out of whether it was about the matter of an issue. The thing is, this isn't an incidental contact. This isn't the car that he drove her to. It was in Loveland, Ohio, which is at the extreme northeast corner of Hamilton County, at least 25 miles.
That's where her car was. Well, there had been no reason to drop her off halfway. She'd been in the same predicament.
But there are a bunch of deputies right across the street at the Justice Center. I'm sure the judge would ask the juror, Mr. Busman, to give her a ride.
Justice Resnick kind of dealt with this issue in State v. Phillips at some length, outside communications with jurors. It seems to me that she and we in that case said that the standard then to judge this by is abuse of discretion, as we said in so many other cases. Abuse of discretion connotes far more than just negligence, doesn't it? And therefore, how can you show that he abused his discretion by rescuing this stranded damsel?
Well, there are other knights available in
question. You stated to Justice Douglas that the prosecutor didn't rebut the presumption. Why do you say that?
I said that because the only thing the prosecutor said in the matter, other than complimenting the judge on his rescuing the animal, was we have no questions. The hearing, which is required, was presided over by the trial judge, who acted as the advocate.
So you think that the trial judge should not have participated in that hearing? You should have called in another judge?
Called in another judge, and even if he were participating in the hearing making a decision, he should not have argued the state's position, which he did. He made it immediately upon starting. He made an opening statement and laid out everything from his point of view. We didn't talk about the case. Is that right, Madam Juror? Oh, yes, sir.
Are we reversing the roles of these parties here? Because the Sixth Circuit, in what is it, Zielinski or Zielinski, whatever the name of the case is, said that really it's the defendant's job to prove that the juror was biased, as opposed to us trying the judge here. The judge doesn't have to prove that the juror is not biased, does he?
I think that the prosecutor does. And it's usually on number one in state courts, according to the Sixth Circuit hearing. We don't have to follow that. It's a federal court. So I'd like to, it's nice to have the opportunity to reverse that. In light of grammar, unless the U.S. Supreme Court would say otherwise, I'd say that the prejudice is presumed the burden is on the prosecution to show that this was not prejudicial. And they did nothing, and I don't necessarily fault them as a tactical matter if the trial judge did it all for them, but that's another violation of getting into abuse of discretion. You can't be the judge in your own case, and you shouldn't be the judge and the prosecutor in your own case either.
Did I understand you to say you wanted to adhere to the Sixth Circuit?
No.
Oh.
This is nice day of the opportunity to argue the other side.
To say that you don't agree with them.
Mr. Heakley, if another judge were to have held the hearing here, what would that judge, what would his or her decision be at the end of the hearing?
Well, it's hard to say because we don't have enough facts in the record here. I think based on the facts in the record, that other judge would have to say either this judge gets off the case and or the jury gets replaced, which would have been the easy way to resolve this in a fair manner to everybody.
Would that be a recommendation to Judge Root, for the trial judge here, or would that be, would the judge have the authority to make a decision in your...
Well, I think he would have to have the authority to make the decision, because it was a recommendation. Then the trial judge here would still be acting as a judge as of well, I respect your recommendation, or I accept it either way. And the thing is, nobody asked them what they did talk about. Page 12 of the brief, I might quote from the judge's post-sentencing language, and it wasn't about this case, but it was the judge's views about the delays inherent in the imposition of the death penalty, talking about cases that he had tried 10, 11, 12 years before, that the people were still alive, about the federal courts, who seemed to not to want to proceed with executions, about a particular judge who he named. What if we talk about that? Lawyers, we all like to give old war stories. People who are not lawyers usually like to listen to them.
Who, I guess I'm wondering then, with regard to the burden of proof, who, assuming a proper a hearing with another judge, I mean, who should have asked that question? Surely, I'm thinking, which side would want it? Go there to ask that question.
I think it's incumbent on the prosecution to go there. I've also, perhaps alternatively, said the defense counsel certainly should have asked anyway. They did have the opportunity to ask. All the trial judge said, I'm going to overrule your motion. This is before the hearing.
Yeah.
You want to ask questions. So they asked a few innocuous questions. How long did the trip take? You didn't talk about the case, right? Well, what did you talk about?
The state, you think it, the state, of course, you think strategically the state may not want to pose that question.
The state?
But if they already had, they had what they wanted. They had, her agreeing to the judge's, his ideas. I suppose in this scenario, the state, why would the state want to ask that next question? But that doesn't dispose of the real problem, I understand, but...
Does the record indicate why the judge changed his mind? He originally said he would remove the juror, and then after this so-called hearing, decided not to remove the juror. Does the record tell us?
He does say, and it's sort of, I think, that this will be read as an attempt to convince the trial, pardon his defense, that they may reconsider. Because, you know, she's not a bad juror, you know, she's going to be on the death penalty. If I were a defense lawyer, I'd want to keep her on, wouldn't you? So then they went on to the questioning and everything, and she stayed on. The defense should have renewed the motion, because they did say, we want her off.
Did he say that in front of the juror?
I don't think so, I'm not certain. It is, that part of the record is kind of agreed. So I'll take a lot of digging.
Would you have us reverse the conviction?
Yes, because this is guilt phase.
If it's guilt phase, we have a confession. I mean, he admitted he did it. So what difference, even if we had substituted a juror here, won't the result be the same? Doesn't that make it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
I don't know the result.
Yeah, now, if the prosecutor did this, if the prosecutor was the one that picked up this juror, then it certainly would almost presume prejudice because of that long trip, etc. But the judge's role is different than that of either the defense attorney or the prosecutor. Don't we have to look at it in that light? The judge isn't taking sides in the case. He's not either for the prosecution or for the defense. He's an independent, impartial, fair adjudicator of the case. So isn't this a little bit different since it was the judge that did this?
Well, this is a lot different. And I would also point out that the jurors are also instructed on the occasion what the lawyers say is not how much is when the judge speaks, that's the law, but entity of law must be followed. And again, if the judge did on this 2025, he's on other subjects, the legal subjects, but he's going to touch on the death penalty, as he did after sentencing, which he had a right to do at that point. Who knows? We don't know. And here's a man on death row, and we have basically a silent record except for self-serving statements of the two people whose conduct was questioned. And nobody challenged them. Even if you're guilty, which I don't concede for this argument, right? Even if you are, turns out we'll hear trial. And if you can't have a trial before an impartial arbiter, and the case is signed. any case is a witness, but he's also the judge. I think what I would do is fall back to make the objection and make sure that they hear. Judge, I don't think you should be doing this. You might take your testimony before another tribunal at another time or whatever, but the facts must be gotten. Here's a man on death row. This is a shoplifting case. Remember, Toomey versus Ohio was only a traffic case. The U.S. Supreme Court said you can't be a judge, basically, in your own case, where your interest is involved, and he has an interest in being found not to have committed a crime. That's his interest. And again, all we get are basically just a few words, unsyllable words from the jury. And again, neither one of them reported it early, as best as we can tell from this record. The defendant who saw it, the defendant who brought the attention. I will give the juror a bit of a break here, because the contact was with the judge. Who did she report to? She could report to the bailiff, but he works with the judge. So they put her in a very awkward position. Nobody asked her a question, which is always should be. Despite all this, can you remain a fair and impartial jury between the state and the defendant? Nobody asked. So she had to be intimidated by the situation. It would have been so easy, again, okay, to avoid any problem, to avoid any appearance of impropriety, to make sure that the defendant has a fair trial for a fair and impartial jury. We're going to have to play it to the jury, it's not her fault.
I want to follow up with Justice Resnick's point about the distinction between the conversation with a judge who stands in the role of the arbiter, not the other, obviously not the other side, do we need to? I guess you say it's presumed error, it's presumed prejudicial, and it's not been rebutted. Is the presumption all? Should that presumption be? Should we have that presumption in where the contact is with the judge?
I think so. Yes. I think it's there.
The other cases aren't with contact with the judge.
I think Boston was.
Were they?
But it is. It can't be rebutted. There's a judge and passenger in a hall and say, "Hi, how are you?
Right.
Happy birthday or something like that." We're talking 20 or 25 minutes, and we give a judge very strong views. I would hold on definitely on the federal court side. The delays and executions on him, who had been a prosecutor, a very effective one for a number of years, and he expressed those.
I know, are we then, that's what I wonder about, are we, in order to get to there in your argument, do we have to presume that he's, because you have to add all these factors that you say he's a person, and all of which must mean he spoke to the juror about something that would have taken her away from her already expressed view that she could be impartial.
Well, that's the thing, we have a silent record. I'm not saying he did, I'm not saying he didn't, I'm saying we don't know.
Nobody's shown them.
We don't know because of the way this hearing was run by this particular judge. Nobody asked the questions that had to have been asked. Here we talked about Little League for 20 minutes, or the Reds, or whatever, okay. I still have a problem with that kind of extended contact. It was very possible to get someone to drive around there within a few minutes.
Extended contact with the judge, you know, as opposed to the other side?
Right. But the judge,
he doesn't represent a viewpoint.
Usually expressed at the sentencing, after sentencing, that's a definite viewpoint. If they discussed...
But they had to have discussed. I mean, his presence doesn't represent a viewpoint. You want to tack on, well, we happen to know he expressed a viewpoint later, or we know he holds these views, but...
I don't want to tack it on. I want a record that shows whether it should be tacked on.
All right.
I'm not saying he said these things. I'm not saying he didn't, and nobody else is. Nobody else knows.
What you're actually asking us to do is, because you don't have any showing of actual prejudice, you're asking us to reverse on the appearance of impropriety.
And the presumption.
And because it's an appearance of impropriety, it is then assumed prejudice against the defendant?
Presumed.
Even though you have really no showing that the defendant was prejudiced by any activity of the judge?
We have a showing that there was improper contact for an extended period of time in the middle of the death penalty trial. And unless they remain mute to both of them for 20, 25 minutes, which I doubt, we don't know.
But wasn't it...
The inadequacy of this hearing, from many different aspects, is the core of our problem.
Was defense counsel precluded from going into and asking questions of the juror?
No, they did ask questions. Well, it's an error here.
The insufficiency.
For not going into it. But on the other hand, to their credit or benefit, I suppose, say, well, wait a minute. They haven't said anything here. We have a benefit of presumption. Do we really want to ask? But they did ask. As long as they asked, they should have asked, what did you tell them? Discretion, and here he is presiding over this hearing as to whether or not he
feel that shows a mindset of the judge?
Tends to that, and those same comments perhaps something like that was discussed on the trip. I don't know. And again, the problem is I don't want to ascribe improper actions to the judge or to the juror or comments, but the record is silent. If he's going to act as an advocate and was aware of the presumptions and everything, I think he would be the one to say what they did fall with that. But again, he doesn't have that obligation, and he did not take the opportunity to exclude that either. There's an issue that came up with the Lindsay case with Justice Cook and Kathy Cook, who argued about the use of the homicide as an element of the aggravating circumstance that came here where the trial court permitted gruesome photos in. And I would only submit that you can commit aggravated murder without committing a robbery. And that's why the aggravated murder is not part of the robbery specification. It's you kill someone with our calculation at times that that's aggravated murder. As soon as you go over and take their wallet, that's aggravated robbery. That's the aggravated factor. But only that shall be weighed on the fact that you kill whatever you're going to do. And again, the prosecuting attorney in the final argument, the penalty phase, we've been over the law on that before, but I would like to point out here that again, it continues to escalate. Here, Mr. Johnson, in the opening portion, was called evil. He was likely to Judas. In the final portion, he was likely to Hitler. And then an argument was made that the woman, the victim, was a wonderful person, which she was, and he is a bad person. That can never be a just reason for executing anybody in this country, because we don't have any aristocracy, but it's a very potent argument. Especially when I wonder all the negative things that came out during the mitigation and really about how good and decent the victim was. But we go down a slippery slope and we start executing people because the persons they kill are better people than they are. Yeah. We have to exonerate everybody who killed someone that the jury felt was worse. Everybody's the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Higley. Mr. Breyer. Breyer, we have a dilemma, do we not?
Judge, I don't believe there is a dilemma, and I think Mr. Haefeli is really somewhat misleading when he says we don't know what happened, because in fact, there was a very complete record developed about this juror.
Let's assume that the judge was perfectly proper in giving the juror a ride home. It was a fairly high crime area, he was concerned about her and so forth, her to her car. But the hearing part of it, can we condone the way in which the entire issue of his contact with the juror was decided?
Judge, absolutely, you can condone it, and I think we can review the record to see that he did everything proper, everything was placed on record. First of all, you're correct when you say that the judge left. He really, I believe, had no choice but to come to this juror's assistance. Maybe the evening. Unfortunately, our courthouse is located in a high crime area. There was a severe thunderstorm approaching. The weather had already gotten bad. As he approached the jurors, he was just being turned away by a bus driver who had told her there was no more buses going out from Lubbock, which is in fact about 20 miles an hour. So she was stuck.
It's been suggested he could have called the sheriff's office for help. Is that not possible?
Or I don't know that that's like possible or not. The sheriff, the jail is close by, but the jail typically does not have people standing around who are capable of going on errands. They're short-staffed.
Sure, but the sheriff's office certainly has deputies that are in cars, don't they? They could have come
sheriff's
and picked her up.
Sheriff's office is closed.
The sheriff's office closes at some time in Hamilton County? They don't work after certain hours?
Judge, downtown is the jail. The sheriff's functional headquarters is out in Hamilton. That's where the patrol people operate. They don't operate out of the downtown headquarters. That's strictly a jail facility and the administrative officers. The sheriff himself is top assistant. The other deputies operate way out on Cable Avenue, which is in the other direction. Be that as it may, the judge did give the boy a ride back to London. Mr. Haefeli says we don't have any idea what goes on. Then he proceeds through this elaborate discussion of this judge's personal views. Where he got them, I don't know. Those are not in the record. Perhaps they're from his personal relationship with the judge. He knows the judge's views. But the judge didn't discuss that. In fact, when you read the record, it's obvious as they come out, they've already been discussing. So we don't have to first raise this issue. I'm certain if given the chance, the judge would have raised it. But when they come on the record, they're already talking about it. And in fact, the juror is brought in and she is questioned by the defense attorneys as to what occurred.
Is it unclear that, I mean, you say I'm sure the judge would have. I guess, are you saying that the judge could have? He did? Or
we don't know, Judge. It's obvious they talked about it. The first thing that appears on the record, I believe, is the defense attorney saying we have this communication from our judge, from our client. That's how it gets into it. So you don't know. They say we've been talking about it. You know from the record they have been. Then they go on the record with it. There's no real way of knowing how it actually was raised.
But are you saying that the judge, obviously he was going to tell them, but
I'm saying.
You're telling us that that's what was going to happen.
I'm saying.
But he was beaten because, to the punch, because defense counsel mentioned it to him first. I can't see any indication whatsoever that the judge was going to say anything about this to anybody.
No, what I'm saying, Judge, is we don't know because it started back there. All that happens on the record, when we get out on the record, they announce that.
Is that not what we'd have to say that because that is our record, it's maybe somewhat significant that it's opened by saying, here's why we're here. Our client has a, no?
I don't attach significance to that. To me, that's the first person who got out.
Who spoke on the record? Who's speaking first? Defense counsel?
I think the judge is speaking first. We're here, and then the defense attorney's launching. But I don't
yeah.
In front of me, and I didn't.
The defendant didn't even know that it was the judge that picked this person up, is that correct?
Hard to say. The judge, I think, is a very tall, physically recognizable person. If you'd been in the courtroom, you would know it was him, I think.
But the defendant didn't say that it was the judge. Didn't he say it was the
court? He said courtroom personnel, but he may have taken that to mean the judge. There's no way it
could. Then the record shows that the judge then just participated openly.
But the fact is, they brought the juror in, and she was questioned. And there is no mystery about what was said, because and the hearing takes place at approximately page 1430 of the transcript, and she says, we discussed nothing.
What is in the record, however, is that the judge said, all right, if you want her off the case, I'll take her off the case. And then when they requested it, he decided not to. How do we deal with that?
That's a discretionary call of the judge whether to remove her or not. And it requires the judge to apply the existing law in deciding whether he should do that. This court in Shepherd adopted the Remmer test. And the Remmer test was contact between anyone and a juror is only presumptively improper if it's about the case. The record already showed the contact was not about the case. It was about giving her a ride back to her car, and the record permanently shows that nothing else was discussed. It's on page 1431 of the transcript where she was questioned. So there is no presumption of improper contact in this case.
You say nothing, the record shows that nothing else was discussed.
They asked her what was discussed, and she said we didn't talk about anything.
Was this after the judge had said that?
I believe it was.
So the judge said we didn't talk anything about the case, and then they asked her about it.
I don't know what the judge, it was after the judge explained what had happened.
All right, well, what do you expect the juror to say?
I expect her to tell the truth.
And what she said was that I didn't talk to nobody about nothing, including my family.
I don't have the exact words in front of me, but something like that.
Well, I can probably give them to you.
If the judge had given the juror talked about his views about the death penalty, just in the abstract, would that be a proper response from a juror to say we didn't talk about the case? She could answer honestly, couldn't she, if he talked about his views about the death penalty generally, or a number of people on death row?
No, I don't think she could say that, because this was a death penalty case. So she couldn't respond to it. I think her response is beyond that. And once we realize what the law is that there's no presumptive impropriety, there's no contact about the case. The follow-up is this court's decisions in Keith and Phillips. And Keith and Phillips, contrary to what Mr. Haefeling has said, this court has said the burden is on the defendant to show there is something wrong. It is their burden. It's not the prosecutor's burden. This court has already spoken on that issue. So there's two key legal decisions here. Remember, which this court adopted through Shepard, that there's no presumptive impropriety where there's no contact about the case, and the Phillips decision, which says the burden is on the defendant to show that there was some adverse impact on the jury.
I take it you agree with the Sixth Circuit, where they say that the defense must prove a bias.
It's a rare day that I can say that, but yes.
Yeah, your roles are switched today, aren't they?
No, because I would never even bring up the Sixth Circuit if you did not. I'm perfectly willing to rely on this court's decision. I don't need background. This court is persuasive enough for me.
So your best authority is Phillips?
Phillips and Keith. In those cases, in any event, make it clear that the burden is on the defendant to show some adverse impact. Counsel alleges that the trial attorney and the defendant are not delving into this. That's totally incorrect. The defense attorneys brought it to the court's attention, they placed it on the record, they got an explanation from the judge, and they affirmatively questioned the juror about the key issue.
Well, wasn't
what did you talk about?
Aren't those cases, don't they deal with somebody other than the judge having the contact with the juror?
I believe they do.
Well, isn't that different?
Well,
here the judge is going to make the judge is going to make the decision as to whether there was an improper contact. Here, the judge made the so-called improper. That's different, isn't it?
Well, I believe that it is different, but it's different in a manner that's more favorable to the state because the judge is not a party. He's a neutral arbiter that's deciding the case. There's no reason at all to presume he would have any improper contact. Why would you even take that step? Is my point. He is a neutral arbiter who's deciding the case. He is not a party. His counsel.
Well, isn't the problem with your argument that though that we as lawyers and judges like to believe that, and we hope it's always true, but there's a perception issue, is there not? A perception of truly fair trial. And here's a judge who has this 25-minute contact with a juror, and sure, we like to presume that they talked about baseball or whatever. They didn't talk about the case, but the problem is the perception that of people involved in the jury trial that there's something a little wrong with that. And then the judge comes in, has a hearing, and decides, well, it's okay. I take it from your brief that you would urge us to not write anything that would say that the trial judge in the next instance when this might occur should do something different, such as have another judge decide the issue.
I would do that. And 2 points. Number one, I don't think that the general public view judges is not being impartial, it's not being fair. I don't think that's true. I think judges are generally held in very high esteem.
No, but we shouldn't be testing their belief in that, should we? Unnecessarily? Isn't that what's happened here? Really, we're really testing their confidence in that unnecessarily. It was easy to correct, was it not, by the judge?
Judge, I can't.
The perception. I'm not suggesting the judge did anything wrong, but there's a perception issue. Fair trial. The judge is the fairest person in the courtroom. And we have a question now.
Well, you know, there's 2 points to that, Judge. Number one, it's my position that the way this was handled by the trial court was the exact proper thing to do. They put it on the record, they brought the juror in, they questioned her. Now, this isn't a case where you can have a misperception because the juror explained what was said. It's all out there.
After the judge said, we didn't discuss the case, did we? I mean, the juror, but really.
I don't agree with the judge.
Well, I'm not suggesting anything improper, but the perception of that is, well, what juror is going to say, oh, judge, yes, we did discuss the case, and the judge just said we didn't.
Judge, we had cases where we had learned of improper juror contact with the attorney. The Shepard case.
Where the judge is not involved, right?
That's true.
Sure, that's the point. That's the problem.
I'm saying there's no reason. I think you're taking an unduly pessimistic view of how people perceive the system. I don't believe that to be
I have the highest confidence in the system, Mr. Breyer. My concern is that we should not give the people a perception that we're not concerned about the fairness of the trial. Perception, not reality, but perception.
And I would go on to say, Judge, that the way this particular trial judge handled that was a very proper method to resolve this. It's on the record. The juror is brought in and explains. I don't know what else you could expect of the judge. There's no precedent for this type of situation I'm aware of.
When you all were handling this, did you look to see whether the judge had violated any of the canons of ethics? Because you know, every one of these cases, and I agree the perception is what maybe we're talking about, but you almost presume that the judge is wrong instead of us presuming the judge is right, which maybe ought to be. I mean, I when I was reading these briefs, I began to think, what if he had been in his car, saw her sitting there, had gone by, and then something had happened to her? And then there was a big investigation. Did anybody see her? What do you suppose the papers would have said about the judge letting a juror sit there at that time of night in those conditions?
Well, that is my point. That is why I'm saying the judge did everything correct. You want to point out, the judge is charged with the care and safekeeping and handling of the jurors. When they're in the courthouse, he provides for their recesses, he provides for the meals, he controls their activity. He has an affirmative duty to look out.
To be fair here, judges also have a duty to avoid contact with jurors. We've said it in Bostic, you know, and it's got to be disclosed right away. I mean, he could have handled it. Quick disclosure, call in another judge. I mean, if you want to be fair about duties, there's that duty. Yeah, you don't know. The issue here is not about whether this judge should have or shouldn't have picked up the juror. The issue is whether or not that juror should have been excused, and if or the proceedings that occur before the decision to excuse that juror.
I would agree with that. To the extent of saying the issue is, did the judge handle it as he should have, and based on what developed, should he have been removed? That's correct.
Right.
Well, don't the circumstances dictate that the judge should have excused the other, that juror, even if either side didn't want it excused? Isn't a judge have to be aware of his activities and the perception that the public has of his activities, because he or she is held to a higher standard of conduct than other people? And shouldn't they be very aware that people take their conduct much greater than the ordinary citizen, and that they should be aware of that at all times? And yes, the judge may have had an obligation to take care of the juror, but I think the last thing that he should have done is picked her up. I think there's a lot of other things that he could have done and would not have had the perception that is left by picking up the juror.
Judge, I personally believe the judge handled it the way he should have. I can understand your viewpoint on that issue, but I think even with your viewpoint, again, it brings us to what should he have done once that happened.
Counsel, you're serious about that? Upon reflection, you would have us right that judges Justice Sweeney pointed out, it's so simple to do any number of things, whether it's calling the sheriff or handling, or it's just as simple as handing the jury $20 and saying, call a cab. I'll wait here and make sure you get a cab. I'll help you call a cab. And the county will reimburse me for this.
There's so many debates I was concerned. No, I can't disagree. I'm certain in retrospect.
I mean, what you're saying is you would have us take the facts of this case and not only affirm the death penalty, but write that there's just positively nothing wrong with this conduct of the judgment.
What I'm asking you to do is apply the existing law that's already here. There was contact, so we go to the first step. Was it improper contact? Was it about the case? That's what the case law requires the review to do. That was done here. It turns out it was not about the case. The second thing I'm asking you to do is to go ahead and apply the already existing law in the village of Keith, requiring the defendant to show adverse impact. The judge gave that opportunity, it was not done. I'm not asking you to do anything new except affirm Remmer and Shepard and Keith and Phillips. And this judge acted in conformity with those decisions. If we could stand here forever and say he could have gotten a kid, he could have done this, he could have done that. The fact is, he was faced with a difficult situation. It's late at night, there's a thunderstorm approaching, it's a high crime area.
How late was it?
I believe it was 6.
It's after dark.
I'll tell you what, downtown Cincinnati is pretty much like downtown Columbus. After 5 o'clock, it shuts down. No one around. It's very isolated.
Was it dark?
I didn't know right away. And I don't mind whether it was dark. I'd like to give you all the time. Where it was like, what the weather was like, and how the school was isolated. Mr. Hayden didn't touch on it.
What's the standard that we judge his conduct on, anyway?
I think, well, there's two things here. Number one, there were certain issues of law he had to apply. And those are pure questions of law. He applied them correctly. Then, did he abuse his discretion by removing them?
Abuse of discretion is the standard, isn't it?
When we get to that point, and since there is no showing whatsoever of any improper contact, that's the step I would need to go.
We said in State v. Adams that the court's attitude, if you're talking about abuse of discretion, it implies that the court's attitude is unreasonable, arbitrary, and unconscionable. That's a pretty high standard, isn't it?
The court affirmed that in Power, which was a death sentence case. 15 Ohio State Third affirmed that same standard. I don't think you could hardly get to that point here. Mr. Hayden used all his time discussing this particular issue. If the court has no questions on the other points, possibly.
What about the alleged prosecutorial misconduct? You didn't talk about Judas, did you?
Well, as a matter of fact, when you read this transcript, you received a very contentious trial. The defense attorneys who handled it were very capable of defending themselves. There was not a single objection to anything said in either phase of the closing statements. No objections at all. As a matter of fact, no one called the defendant Judas. No one called the defendant Hitler. Those names came up in an analogous fashion. They argued that the defendant committed his crime because of his poor childhood, his drug abuse, his slow learner status. The prosecutor simply said, that's not the motive of this crime. The motive of this crime was greed. For Judas, it was 30 pieces of silver. For this defendant, it was $50.
In fact, part of that was in rebuttal, was it not?
That's correct. Both of those remarks were in rebuttal. As a matter of fact, the other point the defendant produced in mitigation is foster mother, who Andy was 3 years old when she was three, when he was 3 years old. She testified that when he was 3 years old, he was a great guy and didn't cause any problems. Well, of course, we can say that about any 3 year old. And that's where the Hitler remark came up. It was not a reference to this guy is Hitler, he's like Hitler.
Some would disagree with you, 3 year olds can't cause problems to drive. I know what you mean.
Well, I would be one of those tonight. But no one called him Hitler and no one called him Judas. And this is a plain matter of fact. There was not a single objection to anything that was said in the closing arguments. It's been assigned to error. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dwyer. Mr. Haveley, you saved just a little over 2 minutes of your time.
Mr. Dwyer, you didn't know where I got my version of what the judge's views are. I got them right out of the transcript, pages 2148. The quotation that Justice Douglas referred to when the lady, the juror, said, I didn't say anything, absolutely nothing to no one, no family, nothing. I was in response. not to discuss it with other jurors, referring to the hearing and what they had just gone through. And then he follows her comment by saying that maybe he had inquisitive as to why he was brought to chambers. So when she said, I didn't say nothing to no one, family or anything, she wasn't talking about the trip with the judge. She was talking about whether she had discussed those proceedings with respect to misconduct that morning or her contact with the judge with anyone else. And it had nothing to do with the content of that conversation. If the burden, as Mr. Breyer says, is on the defendant, that was ineffective counsel for not going through it, the duty to help again, and of course, any ideas I didn't think of by Thanksgiving or Cam or whatever. But one thing, Ms. Miller, if it's bad now, I'll take you home. But, you know, we're going to have to remove you from the jury. We can't have this kind of contact. Value your right home is more important than you get home safely than it is that you stay on this jury. But there's no one else here, and I'll take you home. But that's what we have to do. I'm sure you understand.
Yeah.
That would have resolved.
I'm wondering, Mr. Haefeli, about the real core of your argument on this particular issue is the presumption of prejudice. If that attaches, you know, then we move the burden of proof and all. But in Bostick, of course, the contact was the contact with the jury about the case. And Remmer requires that it be about the case, the contact be about the case at hand. Is that, I mean, are you on solid ground here to invoke the standard, the presumption, where this is outside the courtroom and, you know, can you invoke the presumption or is it not presumed and the burden's the other way?
I think that I'm correct in invoking the presumption. I don't think there's enough in this record. In fact, we didn't talk about the case, right?
Right.
There are so many things, as I point out, with the judge's views that could have been discussed there that would have had an effect on the case. What do you think of all these? I think it's just disgusting how these guys break into homes like the prosecutor.
That's not regarding the presumption. The presumption is something that attaches from the scenario of when it occurred. I mean, in Bostick, it occurred as a part of the jury deliberations, an ex parte, a question by the jury. And here we have something completely, is it completely legally different that the presumption doesn't attach where there's no reason to presume that the contact involved the case?
It's legally different. I think it's in a worse situation. The judge answers a question improperly. Well, the jury asked the question in the first place. This lady didn't ask for anything.
But the issue there was just that it was ex parte.
Right. And this is ex parte. And again, there's so many things. Had they gone a few steps further and inquired as to what was discussed, the fact we didn't discuss this case doesn't take the prejudice away, the potential for prejudice away. Because again, if they talked about criminals, death penalty cases in general, home invasions, any number of things, without mentioning Rayshon Johnson, that would be just as prejudicial. Yeah. And the prosecutor's trying to say, well, they didn't talk about this particular case, therefore, no harm, no foul. And again, my analysis is a fallback position. If they are correct, then the defense counsel were ineffective. And we're sort of intimidated, as you'll see, and they ask just innocuous questions. And here we have a man on that row with all this, and it's been so easy just to replace the juror. And I don't think due process would be tolerated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haefeli. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.